Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality below the surface.
Yes, and this is episode number 57, Night Watch by Sergei
Lukyanenko?
Lukyanenko, that sounds right.
Let's just say that and go from there.
So it was written in Russian.
Yes.
Right? So Russian novel.
From what I understand, this was really, really a popular series in Russia, best-selling series, and then they made movies, Night Watch and then Day Watch, and I know at least the first movie broke all the box office records in Russia, and then they brought it over here, and that's when a small group of, you know, science fiction fantasy fanatics like my kids went, oh my gosh. And I went, really? So we saw it too. And the movie was like, not exactly like the book. It was as if they took pieces of the first two books for those first two movies and kind of wove them together into a story that's of that universe and complementary to the universe with elements you recognize, but not exactly the same. It's very interesting,
interesting what they did.
Yeah, because I liked both of them equally well, although if you watch the movie, it does have a couple of really violent parts. So, especially Day Watch. So.
Day Watch.
In a bathroom fighting a vampire. Just, you know, you don't have to watch the whole thing. It's okay. I'm just saying.
Cool. Yeah, it says here he was born in Kazakhstan and educated as a psychiatrist.
Interesting.
Began publishing science fiction in the 1980s and has published over 25 books.
Yeah, I'd heard he'd published a lot of books, but these are the only ones I could find that have this series, or is the only one I could find that has been translated. Makes me curious about his other ones.
Yeah, yeah. Just on Wikipedia, it gives a list of awards he's won and things, and all of his novels and trilogies. A pentology is what this one's called. Night Watch, Day Watch, Twilight Watch, Last Watch, and New Watch. And have you read all of them?
I have read all of them, except New Watch is still being translated.
Oh, okay. So
and it's interesting because Hannah just finished Last Watch, which is not what you think it is, or not what I would think it is from the title. And she said she was then sitting at Mass yesterday evening, and the talk, since it's Easter, was all about life and death, resurrection, new life in God and in Christ. And she said, I felt like, yeah, I've just been reading Last Watch. Yeah, okay. Because themes in these books are all about good and evil, light and dark, the choices we make, the intentions we have, and how it affects us and other people. And it's amazing to me that he can do this so continually and keep the threads of it feeling so true to life.
Yeah, I really liked the flavor of these books. There was just something about them that was different from things I previously read.
You know, Russian style, I think.
Yeah, my copy. Actually, it doesn't say that on here. I saw somewhere somebody compared it to as kind of an adult Harry Potter.
That's mine says that. J.K. Rowling, Russian style. And I'm like, no, not at all. Nope.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say. It's got a different flavor to it. I guess it's similar in that there are magicians or magic happening behind the scenes, you know, while we humans go on with our daily lives. There are people with powers doing things, you know, while we don't notice them. We can't see them, you know. There's all kinds of things going on that we don't have no idea about.
Yeah,
I guess in that way, that's a similarity to the Harry Potter series, but that's pretty much where that would stop.
it's
a lot different.
Well, and let me just really quickly give a quick summary, I guess. Basically, this is set in Moscow, and most of the books are all set in Russia, except for the last book. Excuse me, Anton does travel to Edinburgh and last watched some. But, and it's interesting when you say the author's from Kazakhstan. I discovered that reading the last book because at one point he goes to Kazakhstan and there's a lot of conversation held about the differences and similarities between there and Moscow. But the whole concept of the series and the book is that there are human beings and there are others. And others have supernatural powers. They are human at the beginning, but when they get to a certain age or a certain knowledge of their power, they are invited to enter the twilight, which is this shadowy world that exists kind of parallel to ours. And they choose there if they're going to follow the light or the dark. And their powers then are used for basically good or evil, although the dark ones are continually denying it's evil. And because a lot of this is about interpretation of truth for yourself. And so basically the night watch are the light ones who are keeping the watch during the night over the vampires, the werewolves, the dark ones who operate mostly at night, and they are enforcing a treaty that was made a long time ago because light and dark would fight and millions of humans would die as a byproduct of that. And since the whole point to the light ones was that they're protecting the human beings from evil, they wanted to stop that, and so they set up a truce, a good deal of which is talked about in this book, that they'll allow some darkness, some dark activity. But they keep an eye on people to go, vampire, you're licensed to have a certain amount of human blood, but we're going to watch you to make sure you're not doing what you're not supposed to.
Yeah, and the reasoning there was that when they were at all-out war, a whole lot of people died.
Right.
So they would say, okay, well, we'll allow this limited activity and less people will die. That was the reasoning given.
To save lives.
Yeah.
So that brings up one conversation of, is that even worth it? Are you doing, if you're allowing darkness to go on knowingly and helping it, and you're hurting some people, is the greater group more valuable than the individual?
Yeah.
And so anyway, Anton, this is all told from Anton's point of view. It's a series of three novellas, two of which can stand separately, I think, as adventures, kind of. The third one really ties the other two together into a bigger story. And he has been always the computer guy. he's a light other who's not that strong. His powers aren't that great, as he understands it. And he's been put onto the street to do watch duty because he needs to know what's happening. You know, they need everybody to know how to do this, and it's his turn. And when the story starts, he's looking for, I guess he's just out on patrol, looking for people who aren't doing the right thing and trying to find people who are breaking the rules. And he comes across Svetlana, who's got this vortex, dark vortex over her head that he can see.
That was such a cool image.
I know. I mean,
it's
subway.
Like this tornado over her head that's, huge. And, she's sitting like in a subway or something or a train.
She's on a subway.
Yeah. And there's a huge vortex spinning around her. And he's thinking, you know, maybe I should get rid of that. And some of the explanations, somebody's cursed her or he had a short list of things that it could be.
Right.
And, magician. Something as big as this one, would be a magician and it's affecting her. She's not feeling all that well or she feels tense or something. And, I just thought that was neat.
Yeah. And he says, that's the kind of thing where, later you fall down the steps and break your leg and you don't ever know why. And he said that, the thing is when it gets really big, when it goes wrong, it's catastrophic. It affects everyone. And so he tries to mess it up by using an amulet he's supposed to use at some other time, or, it's to help him fight evil if it's happening.
Yeah.
He tries to use it on that. It doesn't work. And that's unheard of. So he goes on to, he can't do anything about it. He goes on to do his watch and he comes across a young boy, Igor, who has been called, you know, some magical, come on, Igor, this will be wonderful, that he's responding to supposedly unconsciously. But you see some of it from Igor's point of view, and you find out that he actually is conscious of a lot more than you think. So he's an unusual person also. And he is actually being lured and called by some vampires who are doing what they're not supposed to. So the story goes on from there. You know, it's the adventure story of what happens, all from Anton's point of view. And it's very helpful, of course, to have a character like that, because as he learns the intricacies of what's going on and reviews what the little he does know, we also learn about that world.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a cracking good adventure, for one thing. It's just got this rousing pace that you're just like, oh my gosh. And then they'll switch to, you know, oh, here's Svetlana. And you're like, no, oh, Svetlana. And I'm back to Igor. No, oh, Igor. So it's really good. You get to see the boss of the Light Ones, you know, as they call him, Gasar. Boris Ignatievich or something like that is his human name. You find out who's the head of the Dark Ones, Zabulon. And you meet some other people, of course, as you go. And then that's what launches them into the second novella and then into the third, which makes an overarching story. But because of this conflict they constantly have in running into the Dark Ones, they are constantly having to defend their own actions as Light Ones. And also, because Anton hasn't been actively involved in this, he's been able to take a more academic view of it. Now he's out there really seeing face-to-face the difference that things make. And here we go into the bigger discussion, I would say, because Svetlana eventually becomes part of the Night Watch. He's having to describe to her all the reasons that they rationalize things, because she's seeing it from a very black and white point of view.
Right. And, you know,
why are we allowing, you know, and Igor does too.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, both of them, you know, they're both. Yeah, Anton clearly wants them both to be part of the Night Watch and not the Day Watch.
Right.
Which, you know, is the other side. So, you know, so that's what book two. So the Day Watch is the Dark Ones watching the day, and the Night Watch is the Light Ones watching the night.
Right.
That was pretty cool.
And in fact, Anton gets caught by the Day Watch when he does a little, he does a thing that, and it's one of those indulgent things that he shouldn't have done. It's called a magical intervention, and he's trying to get somewhere, and he's just sick of all these people getting in his way. And he finally, he's like, oh, on you. He says, he does a little intervention to move him out of the way. And he's like, and maybe it'll make your life a little better. And some witch goes, ha, caught you. You're not supposed to interfere.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, it's allowed. It was seventh level, really low. And she's like, not if you remember the Night Watch. And that turns out to be a key factor.
Yeah, yeah.
In the deciding point of that novella.
Right. It is neat how he's, you know, how he worked these out. Yeah, one of the most poignant moments for me was when Igor became aware of what is going on around him. Right. So he knows what's going on. And then he has a conversation with Anton, and Anton is explaining to him how things work, and Igor realizes that Anton would have been forced to allow the vampires to go ahead and eat him.
Yeah.
You know, because
if
of this treaty.
Had a license.
Yeah, if they'd have had a license, exactly. And he was shocked by it. That brought up the whole idea that you brought up a little bit earlier about the individual versus the whole group. You know, is the collective good versus the good of an individual, or the good for an individual, and how those things are often in conflict.
Yeah.
And that's a theme that kind of occurs throughout that I thought was really interesting, really captured my thoughts anyway.
I agree, because I think I always agreed, of course, with Igor and Svetlana. You know, the individual matters because we are those individuals. And the Light Ones were saying, well, yeah, but if it's 100 people versus you. But, you know, when somebody else is making that decision, it's different than when you're making it.
Yeah, and that's true. Yeah. Yeah, Spock making that decision in Star Trek II, you know, he made that decision, right?
Yeah.
But that's, right? Yeah, yeah.
It's different than somebody saying, I order you to go do this.
Mm-hmm. Or I'm going to let you be eaten.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, how good are you then?
Yeah.
You know, you're going to stand there and watch this vampire eat me?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, I don't understand those reasons, you know, so, yeah, it is... That's interesting. And then I think it was Igor who, or it may not have been him, but somebody was saying that how different is the good from the dark?
Right.
You know, because of this, really.
Right.
You know, if you're allowing this stuff to happen, then how good are you, really?
It was either him or Svetlana. Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes Anton will think about that stuff, too.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And he's interesting because most of the other people, except for the boss and Olga, I think, that we meet in this book, and I guess Zabulon, don't think about that stuff much.
Yeah.
They've chosen their side. Done. They'll just do what they're told. Within reason, because they have to be able to think in order to apply their lightness or darkness.
Right, right. Yeah, these characters were neat.
Well, one of the things I really like about these books that is just aside from any of this sort of thing is it really gives you this look into Russian thinking and also Russian life. I mean, you don't see it as much in this book as in the rest of the series, but for instance, Anton will do things like he'll find a bunch of kids somewhere and he'll go, oh, I bought them all a something cola, like whatever their cola is. He goes, I know they would have preferred Coca-Cola, but we've had enough of that Americanization. I feel like I need to keep, you know, that's fine, but we need to keep our own culture.
Yeah, yeah.
And he'll do things like that where...
and the cigarettes,
Yeah, the cigarettes.
There's a cigarette brand that somebody right. smokes that just stinks, and they're like, well, we're still going to smoke it because it's Russian.
Right, yep. Right. Or and there are other things that, for instance... I don't know if it was really obvious in this one. I noticed it because I was rereading it after reading all the books. But they can do things like just stop a car and get in, and the car will act like a taxi. And some of that's because of their influence, but some of it is because there aren't enough taxis.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of evidently during, my husband was saying, during World War II in New York City, you could do that. Huh. Because everybody was off at the war. And so they mm-hmm. would, you know, just stop and they go, oh, okay, here. And you would pay them like you would pay a taxi because I'm going this way anyhow.
Oh, how about that?
And so they'll do that in these books too. And there are certain, as you read other books in the series, you'll see other factors of just regular Russian life that I know are explained more for us by the translator.
Mm-hmm.
Like the kids of certain ages, they all go off to these summer camps out in the woods, and it's kind of like a Boy Scout or Girl Scout camp, I guess, mm-hmm. but it started during the communist regimes, and it's like Hitler Youth in a way. It was to kind of train them to be good young pioneers. Well, they don't have that anymore, communism, but they still have their young pioneer camps that all the kids go to. Well, we would never know that, except I read about it in the book.
Yeah.
As in the next book. The
Gotcha.
Yeah.
The
so
Day
it's,
Watch? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Day Watch. So it's kind of interesting to me to see those little bits of the culture that uh-huh. creep through and the mindset.
Yeah, and like, yeah, that's the whole book has a different flavor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess that's really the only way I really have to describe it. But it's really cool, you know, Anton walking around at night, you know, with his Walkman on, you
yeah.
know, listening to music. And because, you know, he doesn't need his hearing, he says.
Right.
And he just walks around trying to find activity. And
well, and he's, yeah, because it's urban, but it's not like any urban city we've got that I can think
yeah.
of.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's just, mm-hmm. it's very, oh, and this is the thing that I loved at the very beginning, which was intriguing. It says, this text has been approved for distribution as conducive to the cause of the light, the Night Watch. This text has been approved for distribution as conducive to the cause of the dark. The Day Watch. And you start off going, oh, how can that be? And by the end of the book, you're like, oh, I see. Yeah. It shows both sides.
Yeah.
And they each like it because it shows the other side, the bad stuff about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And each book starts off with some statement like that from the Night Watch and the Day Watch. So, yep. but this yep. book was originally, it was written in 1998. And I know the last book, I think, was just written, like, last year or so.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, it says he's 45 years old, born in 1968. So definitely still actively writing.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, I found his blog, and it's all in Russian. And I clicked translate on my Google, and it was interesting. He was writing a little bit about adoption of Russian children.
Oh,
actually, you know what? I'm looking at Wikipedia here. It says his first blog was discontinued after a conflict with readers over the issue of American adoptions of Russian children. So I didn't look at the date on that. Maybe that was...
That's interesting.
2008, yeah.
Well, you know.
Well, there was a news story. Somebody who had adopted a Russian child left the kid in a car, you know, when they were in war at work all day, and the poor kid died of, you know, heat exhaustion, and caused an uproar in Russia.
Yeah.
Saying, why are we allowing these kids, you know, to go over there?
And, well, and then it kind of is interesting because that, in a sense, kind of works back into the view of the light versus the dark. It's like, I understand that uproar, but from what I've read about descriptions of those orphanages, how well are the, you know, I mean, I don't know, and I'm not Russian. So, but what I've read is not like the best thing ever either. So, clean it up at home, and then you don't need so much Russian adoption of kids in America. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe that's what he was trying to say. I don't know. I'd have to read through what he said.
Yeah, exactly. I guess it depends on which readers he was having conflicts with. But it comes back to that light versus the dark, because I thought the description that he gives to Igor, Igor, he is saying, well, what can I become? And he says, well, anyone you like, and your basic choice is good or evil, light or dark. And Igor says, and are you good? Anton says, first and foremost, I'm an other. The difference between good and evil lies in your attitude towards ordinary people. If you choose the light, you won't choose your powers for personal gain. If you choose the dark, that will be what you do most of the time. But even a black magician is capable of healing people and finding people who have been lost, and a white magician can refuse to help people. Then I don't see what the difference is, says Igor. You will. You'll understand when you choose one side or the other. And that's a lot of what the internal conflict and the conversation is about light and dark. Mm-hmm. It all kind of revolves around that sort of thing. And at the end, when he's... the big denouement is coming, and he's got to get a lot of power. He points out that dark magicians can only take power from people when they're sad or in misery, and it increases their misery. And he says light ones can take power only from happy people, but it decreases their happiness. So each way, it's not good for the people.
Right.
He says, but we're allowed to. And I loved his description of all the different kinds of happiness and how he kind of saw it as like different kinds of flowers that he was taking some of.
Right, right.
Because he needed it.
Yeah, that was cool. That was really neat.
Yeah, and he'd kind of worked the system against the dark ones the way they worked it against him in the beginning. So he was allowed to do that, and he wouldn't be charged with violating the law, because the law would be that you can't do that.
Yeah.
But the light ones will let you do it if the dark ones don't stop you. And so that's where you get into this, the whole question of relativism and, you know, that relative moralizing thing that they would do.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have to say, once they got to the end of the book, on the one hand, when the whole point of the entire book was that Gasar did all that maneuvering to get Olga to his level so they'd be equal, so they could have a true love together. And he says, everything I've done has always been toward this goal.
Right. For in his individual.
For his individual gain. And on the one hand, I'm like, oh my gosh, yes, because this is what matters to people. So I was like, this is great. And then the second thing is, you did all this to all these people for yourself. Is that, can that be a light one's act?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
That seems like very selfish.
Yeah.
Like the act of the dark.
Yeah. I marked this thing, the very last page of the first novella. Boris is talking about how frozen he is. And I was just struck by it, and I marked it as I was reading it through the first time. He said, "Anton, I'm frozen," said the boss. He's always called the boss. You know, "I feel cold. As a man, I want to drink a few glasses of vodka." Very last line, it says, "I wiped the snow off my face," and "I" is Anton. And he says, "There was someone waiting for me, and that's the only thing that stops us from freezing solid." And I was just struck by that line. And in knowing now what the end is, you can understand that the author knew full well what he was doing in the first novella.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't like he wrote a novella and then he wrote another one and then he wrote another one. He knew what Boris was up to in the first novella.
Yeah, he was working to that end to make that point. And it's he doesn't really resolve a lot of the questions he asks. I mean, Anton gives the answers, and it all seems very reasonable. But he never really fully convinces Igor. And Svetlana just kind of goes along with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Until the end, when I also thought that was just brilliant, because what he did with his power was he remoralized himself. He knew he'd been so influenced, and Svetlana was saying, "What do I do? Do I go ahead with this spell? Do I stop?" And he remoralized himself, Anton, so that he could give her good advice based on no influence from outside. And he said, "You have to choose for yourself." Mm-hmm. Everyone has to choose for themselves. It's your responsibility.
That's funny. In a confirmation class last night, we were talking about free will and how important it is to the entire, you know, Christianity. I mean, it's vital. It's a vital piece of it. You know, that's, you know, if you point at somebody and said, "You will love me," and that person loves you, I mean, what good is that? What does that mean? It's meaningless, right?
Right.
And, you've got to decide for yourself.
Yeah. He says, "We all create our own destinies. Decide."
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because they've actually got the power of, I don't know what you call it, prevision, where they can look and, you know, the boss does a lot of things because he can predict how Anton's going to act. There are forks of decision, but there are some that are more obvious than others. And you can influence how people act based on, you know, strengthening different choices. And they make the point also that, you know, the dark ones feel like they'll just live for themselves and they're not going to worry about directing everyone, whereas the light ones feel like the only way they can ever stop having to deal with all this is for human beings to choose the light themselves, for all of them to do it. So they're continually trying to create the ideal society. So because of that, they've wound up creating communism, the Russian Revolution and communism, the Second World War. There was something else that I can't remember. There were three things that they... Oh, and now this attempt, I think, is what he said. And I was looking at that going, that's not good at all. You know? And of course, the author's kind of making that point that you can't, there is no ideal society, but yet they keep doing it. And then in the end, Gassara is revealing, well, yeah, that's all a great goal too, but those all served my purpose.
Right.
To get
Luga
back.
Yeah. Yeah. And Anton is not, you know, all good ever. You know, there's a point at which he shoots somebody. And I marked that as well. And he, you know, was a little bit violent. You know, he screamed only once, then two bullets shattered his skull, you know. And then he says, "I waved my hand through the air, grasping and clutching at an imperceptible something flowing through space, the outside layer of it, a copy of the dark magician's human appearance. Tomorrow they'd find him, the wonderful young man everybody loved, brutally murdered. How much evil had I just brought into the world? How many tears, how much bitterness and hate? Where did the chain of future events lead? And how much evil had I killed? How many people would live longer and better lives? How many tears would never be spilled? How much malice would never be stored? How much hate would never even be born?" So he's, you know, conflicted, you know, throughout the whole thing, you know, and that's one of the cool things about this book is his, you know, we're seeing, you know, the whole thing's in first person. We're seeing his inner thoughts all the time. And he's thinking about this stuff all the time. You know, this whole book is him thinking about good and evil and consequences and free will.
Which makes it sound boring.
No, no, it's not at all.
There's action the whole time, but he's having to make decisions as he goes. And
right, right.
So it's kind of a commentary. Well, and I thought it was just brilliant that the second book, it starts from Maxim's point of view. They always start with a prologue that gives you some outside look at what's going on. And Maxim is somebody who, it's discovered later, is a light other, but he's never been discovered, so he's never been initiated, which means no one's been able to say, oh, let us explain everything to you. All he knows is that in the spring and the fall, I guess it is, or the summer and the winter, two times of the year, he suddenly is aware of evil. And he will find that evil, and he will destroy it. Well, what he's able to do at those time periods is discern dark others. And they might not be doing anything bad at all. One of the people he kills is, they make the point that she was a werepanther, but she had never even taken advantage of her allowed, like, her special wedding day license, when she could have killed somebody if she wanted. She never did it. She was always a good person.
Yeah.
But he could see the inherent dark choice she'd made. And he would kill her because all he knew was there's evil out there and I have to do something about it. I'm the only one. And so what you see there is it's someone who is incapable of seeing those gray layers of how do you make a choice. Because even at the end when he's faced with Anton and is it Igor he's trying to kill, I think? And Igor hasn't even made a choice ever. I think. Yeah, he's still got his potential, Anton says. And he said, and he's like, oh no, I have to kill him. Have to. And he's like, but this and this and this. Nope, nope. All I can see is there's dark and there's light. Mm-hmm. And what happens? He becomes an inquisitor, which is like the group of judges that's over everyone. And so what you see is you've got to have somebody who's capable of weighing choices. Because you can't have what Svetlana has been and Igor have been arguing for. You can't have always all good and all dark because you have to be able to say, all right, their natural inclination is to not be a great person. But what are they doing? Nothing. You know, have to be allowed to live, you know, and maybe make those selfish choices. We can't stop them because to do so is to create more evil.
Right, right. Yeah, and you don't really know your consequences, you know. What have you removed from the world? What have you added?
Right.
You know, what did you have the right to do?
Right.
You know, how have you affected everything? And in the meantime, you know, as you get farther and farther in the book, you realize that, you know, people are being used left and right by light and dark. You know, in order, but mostly light, which... you know, because he has a plan. Yeah. Isar has this plan that's, you know, revealed as the book goes on. And he's trying to put everybody into place to, you know, pull off this master plan. And Olga, too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Speaking of Olga, it was pretty cool, the body transfer that happened in the second novella. That was neat. Yeah, you know, and then there's things, you know, like that.
Almost like
that
an episode of Bewitched or something.
Yeah, almost. Yeah.
I bet that was funny. Reading that whole one, I remember thinking, I was like, oh my gosh, can't we tell something's going to happen? We're all on vacation. We're all going to Tiger Cub's house out by the lake. And you're just like, oh, I've seen this on TV shows and movies before. And then they changed the bodies thing. And I'm like, is this Bewitched? What's going on here?
That's funny.
And it's more serious, but it's like, what? Because when Svetlana's like, what? This is ridiculous. And I was like, especially the second time through when I knew a little bit more about it, I was thinking about it and I was like, wait a minute, that reasoning he gave was bogus, completely bogus, but everything's happening so fast.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anton goes for it.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. And then they, that's when we first learned the real name of Boris.
Oh,
when
yeah.
She invokes it to switch back.
Oh yeah. 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 That's right.
Yeah. And
this
neat.
Is kind of that thing of that I understand that Russian novels do this anyway, because of trying to read the Brothers Karamazov, where they have to talk about it at the beginning, they can have their own name, but they can also have this infinite number of nicknames. Huh. And so then you get to the boss, and he's Gasar, he's Boris Ivanovich, he's whatever, you know, and it's like he can have 12 different things referring to him. You have to kind of know what they are and follow him.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I remember in the novel, when I first heard, you know, the word the boss, I was thinking that they were talking about God and Satan.
Oh, you know, as the bosses. That's interesting.
Yeah, that's what I thought that was going to happen, but, you know, it wasn't.
Yeah.
That would have been neat. Not that it wasn't neat already, but
yeah. Well, that's
yep. In the future books, are they all novella length as well?
Mm-hmm. They're all this way. They're all three novellas.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, the first two are standalone type stories. I mean, you know, it's very helpful if you know something that happened before, but you don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third one will tie it up.
That's interesting. I wonder if they were originally published like in a magazine or something.
Well, that's what I was wondering when I read the first one, especially. Although I would say that the second book, I think, to me, is the weakest of all of them, partially because the first two novellas are told by two different people, and it's from a dark point of view. The third one's told from two or three points of view, one of whom is Anton.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not, the stories aren't as strong, but also part of it is because I don't really like seeing the point of view of the dark ones. That's when you realize how selfish they are and how they really don't care about anyone but themselves, especially from the first book. You know, I was just like, oh, I can't tell if it's that I don't like his writing. And I asked Hannah and she said the same thing. She said, yeah, I read that as fast as I could because I really didn't like this person.
Hmm. Interesting.
And she wasn't necessarily an objectionable person. You know, her... She wanted the same things everyone wanted, but the way she went about them and the way she just didn't care about other people is what made the big difference. And I was thinking of, I liked the way that Anton says, I can't remember, who's he talking to? This is when he's talking to Maxim, where he's saying there is a difference between light and dark. Whoops. And he says, is he a dark magician? Talking about Igor. He says, probably. I'm afraid you're right. In a few more years, this kid will start to sense his own powers. As he goes through life, the dark will creep alongside him. With every step, his life will become easier and easier, and every step will be paid for by someone else's pain. Do you remember the fairy tale about the mermaid? A witch gave her legs. She could walk, but she felt like there were red-hot knives stabbing into her feet all the time. That story's about us, Maxim. We always walk over sharp knives, and that's something you can never get used to. But Hans Christian Andersen didn't tell the whole story. The witch could have done things differently. The mermaid walks, and the knives stab other people. That's the way of the dark.
Huh. Yeah, that's neat.
Yeah, and then Anton says, I carry my own pain with me. Or Maxim says, and Anton suddenly felt an insane hope he could understand after all, but that mustn't be allowed to change anything. And that's his inflexibility. He feels that pain, but he won't be flexible at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that, it all goes back to free will. I mean, that choice is the choice that we make. Do you cut someone off in traffic? Because that's just easier.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, are you causing them that little bit of anger or frustration or whatever? What kind of a day have they had? What is this going to do to them? We don't know. Are we thinking about ourselves, or are we just going to go, oh, just take it, whatever, go ahead? I mean, that's, you know, Anton is making big choices, but he makes the point constantly that it's all these little choices too. And that's where most of us are living our lives, in all the little choices we make.
Yeah. Yeah. And I marked another thing that kind of ties into that, but it has to do with truth.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, I'll just read it. I'm looking it over and I'm thinking, you know, But Anton says, no, I said with a shake of my head, that's part of the truth too. Sveta, we are not given the chance to choose absolute truth. Truth's always two-faced. The only thing we have is the right to reject the lie we find most repugnant. Do you know what I tell novices about the twilight the first time? We enter it in order to acquire strength. And as the price for entering it, we give up the part of the truth we don't want to accept. Ordinary human beings have it easier. A million times easier, even with all those disasters and problems and worries that don't even exist for the others. Humans have never had to face this choice. They can be good and bad. It all depends on the moment, on their surroundings, on the book they read yesterday, on the steak they had for dinner. That's why they're so easy to control. Even the most malicious villain can easily be turned to the light, and the kindest and most noble of men can be nudged toward the darkness. But we have made a choice.
Go ahead.
No, I just find that interesting. And in that paragraph, you know, I start to see Twilight a little bit differently too.
Mm-hmm.
The whole concept of Twilight in the whole book as kind of a neutral place.
When you step into it, you can see things for what they really are. You see the people for what, you know, like Zabulon doesn't look like a kind of an old man anymore.
Mm-hmm.
He looks like a lizard.
Right, right.
You know, it's what he's turned into. And he at one point tells Anton, I saw you in the twilight too, and you didn't look like a saint or something like mm-hmm. that. You know, you didn't look like an angel with a sword.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when it occurred to me, oh, I don't know what Anton looks like in the twilight.
Yeah, they don't tell us, do they?
Mm-mm.
But yeah, I mean, that's an interesting statement. Again, you know, it ties into free will and things. But it's interesting that he's saying, well, you know, humans, we can nudge them any which way. The most malicious villain can easily be turned to the light, and the kindest and most noble of men can be nudged toward darkness. That's probably so. You know, it's a
right.
You know, it's, you know, people can be nudged any which way. You know, it's a, you know, we've talked before about how sometimes, you know, marriage and things, you know, it's a mm-hmm. constant decision all the time, you know.
Well, the other thing too I was thinking about is to take this to a Catholic Christian point of view is that's it, to a lesser degree, it might be that strong because we're just not aware of the invisible world.
Mm-hmm.
But really, that's like talking about the forces of darkness and light from an angelic point of view. Because I was thinking, you know what? What keeps the nicest person from being turned to the dark is how close are they to God? How willing are they to let God help them and to let God's grace move them to a place they wouldn't be otherwise? Mm-hmm. We do need help. And that's where you call on your guardian angel. You ask the saints, the ones who've gone before us, for help that's needed. So I don't know if you can hear that. My dogs are like wagging right against the door. Bam, bam, bam.
Oh.
But I was just thinking about that. And I was going, because that whole nudging this way and that way, those are those, you know, those little thoughts that pop into your head of, oh, you know, I should be instead of being sorry, I almost don't have enough money to pay these bills and I'm worrying about where it's coming from. I should be thankful I have enough.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I ran into yesterday when I was paying bills on the 15th, April 15th. And I was going, thank you. Thank you that this worrying keeps me closer to you. Thank you that I have enough. There are many who don't. Well, that's that nudging.
Mm-hmm.
Is that my own internal mind? I don't know. It's not the kind of thought I normally have. I, you know, what was it, God reaching to me? Was it my guardian angel going, hey, come on. You know, was it a saint who's like, I've been there
mm-hmm.
praying for me? We, you know, and there are the same urges from the dark side. There is, this is the thing that everybody, all those saints keep pointing out, and that Christ himself pointed out, you know, the dark, he tells Peter, the dark one has asked to sift you like wheat or something, to grind you like wheat or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, but I've prayed for you to be strengthened. There's a constant inimical dark battle going on too. They don't want us to succeed. And why? Not because it gets them anything, but because they win, but we lose. That's what they want.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's, something, it makes me sound like a loon, I guess, but if you're not Christian, or some other faith that recognizes that struggle. But there's us. We definitely make a difference. The choices we make make a difference. But we have to always try to cling to Christ, who wants our greatest and best good, even if we can't see it at the time, even if we have to walk on knives to do the right thing. And that's where Maxim, he was willing to walk on knives, but he wasn't willing to think about the other person instead of himself. You know?
Right, yeah.
The dark magician who he kills in the bathroom, who was doing nothing other than having dinner with his regular wife and son.
Yeah.
So, I don't know if this... Sorry,
no,
I just...
No, well put. Very well put.
Well, I really hadn't equated it. I mean, it seems like it would be a natural equation, but because they're so based in the real world and they were humans, you know, but that's the thing we shouldn't forget. There are those invisible forces always working on us.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
why we just have to try to cling to God.
Right. And keep making choices.
Yeah, right, exactly, because the thing that I liked too, and this goes along with what you read, there's a point where he's in the second novella, and he's talked to Maxim, and he's thinking about, well, I guess he hasn't really actually talked to him yet. I can't remember exactly what point this is, but Anton is where he'd killed the first vampire, and he says, everything had seemed so simple and clear. I was like a fresh young American cop going out on my first patrol. And I thought this was fascinating. This is the example they choose. I don't know if it's the translation or if he actually used it. Because earlier in the book, somebody's protesting because he doesn't want to go try to seduce Svetlana. And he says, I don't want to. And he says, this isn't a democracy. This isn't the States, says the boss. I will tell you what to do. You don't get to choose because you don't feel like it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was hilarious, that comparison with America. But he says, enforce the law, hunt down evil, capital E, protect the innocent. How wonderful it would be if everything could be always as clear and simple as it used to be when you were 12 years old, or 20. If there really were only two colors in the world, black and white, but even the most honest, conscientious cop raised on the resounding ideals of the Stars and Stripes has to understand sooner or later that there's more than just dark and light out on the streets. There are understandings, concessions, agreements, informers, traps, provocations. Sooner or later, the time comes when you have to betray your own side, plant bags of heroin, and hit people in the kidneys, carefully, so as to leave no marks behind, and all for the sake of those simple rules. Now, this is where I looked at it and I was like, no, I don't agree. I understand what Anton's saying. And the cop analogy is brilliant, but still, our ideal is the simple cop who would say no.
Right, right.
You know, so
individual is important.
Right, you know? And I don't know, and I think that's actually kind of funny because that's what he's telling Maxim. Maxim is saying, no, I can only see good or bad. He's not looking at the individual, and Anton's saying, look at the individual, but then he's justifying the light one's rules where they will work with darkness. Because that's right, the whole second book is about that.
Well, I'm going to read that.
Oh, I'm sorry, not second book, second novella.
Okay, yeah.
But all the books are about that, but it's interesting when you read the other books, this whole theme gets developed more and more and more so that each book has a different point behind what he's talking about.
Hmm.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, which is what keeps you reading it. It's not just because the adventures are interesting, though they are. He's developing it to a bigger and bigger and bigger level. And I have to say, the end that he reached with Last Watch, I couldn't wait till Hannah finished reading it so that I could go, oh my gosh, did you see this? And she's like, I know, isn't that so Christian in a way, so perfect? And I was like, in a way it is. And it's not a Christian book at all, and it's not... I think somewhere in like maybe the second book or something, someone casually says, hey, I'm a Christian, watch it. And they're a dark one even.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. And it's just kind of a casual thing. And we do have believers. Some of them are believers. Mm-hmm. So, but that's really not a feature. It's really talking about the choices that we make.
Yeah.
Well, at the time having amazing adventures. So
that's neat. Yeah. This book makes me want to to check out some more books in translation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I really enjoyed it. Again, you know, I keep talking about the flavor of the book, but I really liked it a lot. And how it was different from most of the stuff that I read. You know,
yeah.
I liked those differences quite a bit.
Yeah, it made me want to find more Russian modern science fiction and fantasy.
Yeah.
The really old stuff. I mean, mm-hmm. the old stuff's fine, but it tends to be super depressing a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
This at least had hope. You may or may not like the way that Ghisar did what he did, but at the end, it was like, oh, he's a human being. I don't like what he did, but I understand it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Anton, what Anton did was, of course, he's our hero.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he did was the right thing. The remoralization.
Right, right.
The free will for
Svetlana. This is not right. Even though I'm a member of this group, I'm not accepting this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not leaving the group.
Kind of a statement of the individual.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Svetlana did leave the group.
Mm-hmm.
She says, I'm not going to be part of the Night Watch anymore.
Yeah, she's not going to be part of any of it anymore, pretty much.
Right. Right, exactly.
Yeah. She's I'm going to go back to the whole thing. You guys are crazy.
Yeah, yeah. And she's a great enchantress.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So that's a great loss for them, but it's an interesting choice to have. So now you have this great enchantress out there without being part of the Night Watch.
Yeah.
Or Day Watch.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Neat.
Well,
so
I'm glad you liked
selecting it. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. So if people have any suggestions of, you know, I don't know, French fantasy or science fiction or, you know, just something that's different, I'd be really interested to see what it's like.
And I would too. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would love to read some science fiction from other countries. You know, this is more of a fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
But it'd be neat to see what's going on in the thoughts of other places, you know, as far as science and things go. I wonder if I'll start poking around, see what I can find.
Yeah, that'd be good. And like I say, current would be interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you always hear about these old Russian science fiction authors or whatever, mm-hmm. and that's all fine, but you know, it's kind of like old American science fiction. It's really great for what it is too.
Uh-huh.
But to get the flavor of what's going on and how people think now, you have to read something current also.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I love current American science fiction as much as I could. We've talked about that ourselves before.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's lost an edge.
It has. It's lost, whatever we want to call it. It's not as interesting as it used to be.
Mm-mm.
Seems it's to be, you know, British science fiction seems to be going through a kind of a renaissance or has.
Yeah.
Maybe it's already happened. There's a lot of British authors that are active right now that are pretty darn good.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true, and we'll get more of those because not only is it the common language and understanding, mm-hmm. but it's just we're more in communion. I guess it's the language part because you can just pick up one of those books. So
right.
Anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So there we go.
Yeah, that reminds me. You know, somebody who could use prayers. I don't know if you'd want them or not, but Ian Banks. Have you heard of?
No.
He's a fantastic British science
fiction
writer.
Yeah. He needs prayers for
He
what?
Does. He has terminal cancer.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
All
he's
right.
going to, I mean, we're talking months, it looks like.
Well, you know, how old is he?
I don't know for sure. I don't, you know, I'm going to guess something around 60.
Okay. Well, I was going to say, you know, it's one thing if somebody's 75.
Mm-hmm.
I feel sorry for them, but no one's getting out of here alive.
Yeah.
And if that's how you go, that's how you go. But I'm like, but when somebody's younger, then it's just, sad.
Yeah. He was born in 1954. He's Scottish.
Oh, so he's just a few years old.
And he's written the culture novels. I've only read one of them and I really liked it. It was called Consider Phlebas, written in 1987. And he was still writing those.
Okay, I haven't read any of his. I've seen his name.
Mm-hmm.
But see, I have to have people like you or, you know, Jesse or whoever. Tom Homey, since he hasn't been mentioned, or Jenny to push me into it.
Heck yeah, yeah.
So
it looks like he's got a book coming out called The Quarry in June of this year. And that will probably be his last novel.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. And now let's see. We need to go soon, but next is Of Gods and Men.
That's right. Yep. Of Gods and Men.
Sorry to just kind of break it off.
But. Yep, movie. And then after that, we'll do Jesus of Nazareth by Pope Benedict.
Right.
From the baptism in the Jordan to the transfiguration.
Yep.
So, yeah, looking forward to that. I'm well into it.
Yep, me too.
So.
Really liking that book.
Yeah, what a book.
Oh, my gosh, what a mind.
Oh, yeah.
And a heart.
Right, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And then after that is my picks, right?
Yeah.
I don't think I've selected a movie. But I have picked the book.
Remember, this is news to me, folks.
I talked to you about it a little bit and I said, I think I'm going to pick this. But what I'm going to pick is The Terminal Man or The Demolished Man, The Demolished Man by Alfred Bester.
Okay. Yeah, you were just never very positive about it, so I kind of would just go, I could read that. Mm-hmm. I've mentioned like five books to you, like, oh, maybe we should read this. You know, I get a little enthusiastic.
That's okay, classic science fiction. It's a sort of a, you know, how could a murder occur in a society where telepathy is, you know, everybody's a telepath? How can you get away with murder? So that's The Demolished Man.
Yeah, and he didn't write a lot of books, but the books he wrote were so good. Mm-hmm. And he wrote in the 60s or 70s, I guess.
Mm-hmm. 50s, I think. Yeah.
Oh, 50s, really? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, see, I'm really
and his book, The Stars, My Destination, was probably the reason this podcast exists. Partly.
Is it?
Partly. You remember we did the podcast.
I do remember that.
On that, and after that, we had a discussion about... You know, hey, there's a lot of things we could have talked about, you know, that were really Catholic things.
Yeah.
In that book. And that kind of started the wheels turning.
Oh, for you. Yeah.
For me, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I kept trying to get you to do it. I want to hear the podcast. And then I read The Reapers of the Angels. I'm like, well, I've got to talk to somebody about this.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it was the impetus.
Rest is history.
Yeah. So we see the path behind us so clearly of the choices we made.
That's right. That's right. So great. Okay. Well, thanks everybody for coming. Yeah. Thanks for listening.
As if
everyone's in this room. Yeah.
Thanks for having us in your house.
Thanks for having us. Does anyone need more tea?
Yeah. And I made some cookies. Sorry, I didn't have Russian cookies for today. But okay, thanks everyone, and you know, I'm looking forward to a couple weeks from now when we talk about Of Gods and Men.
That's right. It's going to be good. Thanks everybody.
Have a great couple weeks.
All right, you too. Bye bye.
Bye.